come up on the tight wire.
I'm here in Studio B, and I'm sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend, Benjamin Alira Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
We are going to do a special show.
On poetry.
Today, our guest is... Actually, we have no guest today because we are going to do a special show.
On poetry.
On our favorite poems, our favorite poets, and just talk a little bit about poetry itself.
Absolutely.
And the whole show is going to be dedicated to that.
So actually, we do have a guest. We have guests.
Yes.
Poems.
Yes. And we have guests who are both alive and dead. I have some dead poets that I want to read, like Garcia Lorca and Gabriela Mistral.
I think all of mine are dead.
Oh, that would be a good... album cover, you know, all my dead poets.
The Dead Poets Society.
Or all my poetry friends are dead or something like that. Now it sounds too Tom Waitsy. Why did we decide to do this show, Ben? Let's give him a little background on the show.
Well, because really the focus of our show is writers and their writing. But today we're really focusing more on the writing than the personality of the writer, although these poets did have personalities.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we had the fantastic poet W.S. DiPietro on the show the other day, and when you asked him who his poetry influences are, I loved his answer. He said, I don't necessarily have poetry influences, but I have poems and poets that I return to over and over again. And so I brought some poems and some poets that I'm always returning to. I always like to reread. I go back occasionally and I read them. And I know that on unconscious levels, they've influenced me. Because when I look at the poetry that I've written, and I've only done one book of poems so far, and I've just finished it and hasn't been published yet. But when I look at some of the poems, I realize, man, I stole a lot of lines. But great poets.
Really, and we do that. We don't do it consciously.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the weird thing. We just do it and we realize, even if it's just a rhythm, not necessarily the same words. And I'll give you an example. There's this poem that I love. It's Poema 20 from Pablo Neruda's 20 Poemas de Amor. I'm not going to read that today, but there's this line I love where he's walking through the city thinking of his love, right? And he has this line, a lo lejos alguien canta. A lo lejos. And I just love that rhythm. You know, in the distance, someone singing in the distance. And I know I've used that rhythm quite a bit, not only in my prose, but now in my poetry. And I'm not consciously doing it. I just, you know, maybe when I'm in a poetic frame of mind, these rhythms of my ancestors in poetry return to me.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. I don't think that's even the right word.
Right.
We borrow or we learn from, and they speak us, and then we speak them.
Right. Well, you know, one of the cliches in poetry, everybody in poetry knows this, good writers borrow, great writers steal. So we're gonna talk a little bit about the poets, the poems, and maybe read some. And who wants to start? You want to start?
I'll start. I was looking through Franco Harris poems because I really like Franco Harris.
Me too.
And I think he's wonderful, and he's been a great influence on me because he taught me that you could be sincere and ironic all at once, and that's a difficult trick to pull off.
Oh, absolutely.
And he was also a very urban poet. I loved his self-deprecating humor.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read a poem that I really love of his, though it's not a famous poem of his.
Okay.
I think his most famous poem is Why I Am Not a Painter, which I love. So I'm not going to read that. I'm going to read his poem, Homosexuality. Homosexuality by Frank O'Hara. So we are taking off our masks, are we, and keeping our mouths shut, as if we'd been pierced by a glance. The song of an old cow is not more full of judgment than the vapors which escape one's soul when one is sick. So I pull the shadows around me like a puff and crinkle my eyes as if at the most exquisite moment of a very long opera. And then we're off, without reproach and without hope that our delicate feet will touch the earth again, let alone very soon. It is the law of my own voice I shall investigate. I start like ice, my finger to my ear, my ear to my heart, that proud occur at the garbage can in the rain. It's wonderful to admire oneself with complete candor, tallying up the merits of each of the latrines. 14th Street is drunken and credulous. 53rd tries to tremble, but it is too at rest. The good love a park and the inept a railway station. And there are the divine ones who drag themselves up and down the lengthening shadow of an Abyssinian head, in the dust trailing their long, elegant heels of hot air, crying to confuse the brave, "It's a summer day, and I want to be wanted more than anything else in the world."
Thank you. That was Frank O'Hara's Homosexuality?
Yes.
Fantastic poem. You know, there's this quote that I open a poem with that I included in my collection. The poem is called My Grace Has a Man in It, and the quote is from Frank O'Hara, "My quietness has a man in it." I love that line, and so it kind of inspired another poem. And then there's Billie Holiday, who I also quote, that has a line, "My blues has a man in it."
Yeah. Well, you know, Frank O'Hara is so funny. He has that wonderful poem called Poem. And,
oh, yeah.
And he begins, "Lana Turner has collapsed."
Yeah, that's
which
a great
is really,
poem.
Really funny. Yeah. And at the end of the poem, he says, "I have gone to many parties and have acted perfectly disgusting, but I have never collapsed. Lana Turner, we love you. Get up." That is really funny, and he can be very campy, but he always somehow there's a seriousness to him, a serious-mindedness to him that reminds me of a great comic. You know, great comedians always make you laugh, but there is something very painful underneath.
Absolutely, and most good comedians start out their set with self-deprecating humor. And I think that's one of the things that makes us follow them, because they're not arrogant. They're not, you know, out there saying, you know, "I'm all this." The self-deprecation makes you trust them in a bit.
And a bit, because they're kind of unreliable narrators.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he says in Meditations on an Emergency, one of the lines he has in there, which is really lovely, which I really love to quote, "I am the least difficult of men. All I want is boundless love."
That sounds reasonable to me.
Well, Daniel, what about one of your poems?
I picked several. I've been a fiction writer. I was a fiction writer first, and I just started to get into reading poetry, because once you start hanging around with the writing community, inevitably you start hanging around with poets. And when you hang around with poets, all they want to do is read poetry to you and say, "Oh, you got to check out this poem." And my roommate for many years was Andres Montoya, who is the famous Andres Montoya of the Andres Montoya Poetry Prize. Before he died, we were roommates for a very long time, and he used to read poems to me all the time, and he would really get into it. And I think he was the one that got me, you know, started to not only like poetry, but to begin my love of poetry with the Latin American poets. I started to read Neruda and Cesar Vallejo and all these wonderful Latin American poets. And then I found Gabriela Mistral, who I thought was the very first Latin American to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. And I started to get into her, and I thought she was pretty cool. But one of the things that I realized about her, and I'm not an expert on Gabriela Mistral at all, but she would always write about relationships, you know, and her pain of not being in a relationship and not having a family, not being a mother, which was kind of interesting because at the time I had just broken up with somebody, you know, which I tend to do a lot in my life or be broken up by. But and reading her poems really, really touched me. And this is one of the first poems by her that I fell in love with. It's called God Wills It. And it's essentially about, she's saying to the guy that left her, "God wants you to be with me." And it's a little scary. It's a little scary. But some of the lines are just amazing. So I'm going to read God Wills It by Gabriela Mistral. She's from Chile, and she was also one of Neruda's mentors. He learned from her. He was her student. God Wills It. "Earth will turn against you if your soul betrays my soul. A shudder of anguish will run through the waters. The world has been brighter since you made me yours. When we stood silent by a flowering thorn and love's fragrance pierced us like the thorn. But earth will send forth vipers against you if you betray my soul. I will break my barren knees no child sits upon. Christ will die in my heart, and the door of my house will break the beggar's knocking hand and turn the suffering woman away. 2. Every kiss your mouth gives reaches my ears, for the deep places of the earth echo me your words. The dust of the pathways holds the scent of your foot soles, and through the mountains I track you like a deer. The clouds above my house show me the woman you love. Sneak like a thief to kiss her in the darkness under earth, but when you tilt her chin up, you'll see my tear-stained face. God will keep the sun from you if you don't walk beside me. God won't let you drink if you don't tremble on the water. He won't let you sleep except in the deep nest of my hair. If you go from me, you crush my soul even in the moss of the road. Hunger and thirst gnaw at you on every hill and plain, and wherever you go, sunset will bleed my wounds. And I slip from your tongue, though you call another woman, and I stick like the taste of brine in your throat. And whether you hate or praise or plead, to me you cry, to me alone. If you go and die far from me, you'll hold out your hollowed hand for 10 years underground to catch my tears, feeling the trembling of the suffering flesh until my bones crumble into dust on your face. Ah, I wouldn't break up with that woman.
I wouldn't have ever dated her.
Yeah, it's a little extreme, but I love that line that, you know, if you will die of thirst if I am not trembling in your glass of water. Because it's such a beautiful image, because you see him like, you know, she has to be so close that her reflection is in his glass of water. Otherwise, he's never going to drink again.
Yeah, it's the really interesting poem, Daniel. And I think it really captures, you know, a kind of passion for someone that it's not normal. But she's not going for normal.
Right, right. Absolutely.
You know? And it's really interesting. It's really, because I think she's really in the moment of those emotions. And then she really goes with it. And she doesn't turn away from it. She's not trying to make herself look good.
Right. And the fact is, you know, we've all been through, most of us have been through failed relationships. And a lot of times when you're still, immensely in love with the person who left you, you have those feelings. Those feelings are there. Like, you know, like, no, God wants us to be together, you know, and no, you can't. I remember when I was in junior high, the very first time.
Even though God has nothing to do with it.
Exactly. It's just your feelings. But I remember one time in junior high, I tried to break up with my girlfriend. She goes, no. I go, what? She goes, no, you can't break up with me. And she goes, we're still together. And, you know, it was really scary. But I don't think, the poem necessarily advocates that feeling as much as it, you know, articulates what a lot of us feel.
Right. And love isn't always that sweet thing that you read about in a Hallmark card.
Right. Absolutely. You know, when we had, we did a show a while back where I talked about Rodriguez, that kind of folk singer, Chicano guy from Detroit, and he has that wonderful line that I love so much. He says, you know, hello always ends with goodbye.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So, yeah. What about another poem from you, Ben?
I chose Cadman by Denise Levertov.
Oh, nice. She was your mentor.
Yes, and I actually have a broadside of this in my office. And the sad part of that broadside is that she signed it in this ink, and it says, with love for Ben. And you can hardly read it anymore because it's faded.
Mm.
And so I'm going to try to bring it back to life somehow by rubbing something on it because it says an indentation on it. Anyway, I love this poem, as I love many of her poems. Cadman by Denise Levertov. All others talked as if talk were a dance. Clodhopper, I, with clumsy feet, would break the gliding ring. Early, I learned to hunch myself close by the door. Then, When the talk began, I'd wipe my mouth and wend unnoticed back to the barn to be with the warm beasts. Dung, dumb among body sounds of the simple ones. I'd see by a twist of lit rush the motes of gold moving from shadow to shadow, slow in the wake of deep, untroubled sighs. The cows munched or stirred or were still. I was home and lonely, both in good measure, until the sudden angel affrighted me, light effacing my feeble beam, a forest of torches, feathers of flame, sparks upflying. But the cows, as before, were calm, and nothing was burning, nothing but I, as that hand of fire touched my lips and scorched my tongue and pulled my voice into the ring of the dance. I love the poem because she's a wallflower. She doesn't know, she can't be pulled into the ring of the dance because clodhopper eye with clumsy feet. And yet she becomes the poet at the end. She goes away from people and into the barn with dumb animals and cows particularly, she mentions in there. They're not too terribly bright. And yet there she is alone. And then something hits her. She goes, I was at home and lonely, both in good measure. Yeah. In other words, you know, she's pulled home and lonely, both in good measure. And then an angel affrighted me. And so this angel scares her, lands on her, and is there. And it's the muse. It's like, right. And then she, and then there's sparks, and then, but the cows as before were calm, but she's not. But the cows as before were calm, and nothing was burning, nothing but I. As that hand of fire touched my lips and scorched my tongue and pulled my voice into the ring of the dance. This is how she dances.
Through her poetry.
Through her poetry. Yeah. And I think, how lovely, how beautiful,
yeah.
How you can take something simple. There you are, a wallflower. I mean, we've all known that, right? I don't know how to dance. I'm a wallflower. Right. And you kind of skulk away. She skulks away, but then she finds, she doesn't skulk away just to say, well, I can't dance. I'm no one. She goes, and then she finds her own dance.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful poem.
That's interesting because I think that a lot of poets publicly appear to be extroverts, but inside they're introverts and inside they're wallflowers, even if the perception, the public perception of them is not that. And I think in many ways you and I are like that. You know, we tend to publicly seem to be gregarious and always having fun, and but a lot of times we're just feeling completely alienated and
I know.
Alone.
I often like to say I am the most introverted extrovert right. I have ever met.
Right. And I think a lot of poets are like that. You know, it's interesting. Before we started the show, our producer, Norma Martinez, knowing what we were going to talk about, said, are you guys going to read some poems this time that rhyme? And of course, she was joking. But it did make me think about how when I first started to read poetry, I would just read something, you know, by Frank O'Hara or anybody and go, I don't get it. I just don't get it. You know, what's great about this? But the more I became a reader of poetry, I would have these epiphany moments and suddenly the entire poem just lit up. And I understood it. It's almost like—
And you were in the ring of the dance.
Yes, yes, absolutely. It's almost like— you know, reading Sound and the Fury for the first time when I was reading the Quentin chapter, which, you know, comes right after the Benji chapter, which completely left me in the dark.
And the Benji chapter didn't?
No, that's what I'm saying. The Benji chapter completely left me in the dark. And when I'm in the Quentin chapter, suddenly I understood everything. And it was like this, oh, man, it was almost like, you know, when you're reading a holy book and suddenly, you know, you realize what God means. And it was like, dong! And now with poetry, that's the case. You know, now I understand it because I'm able to enter into it and be that wallflower. But that poem is really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure. What's your next poem?
Okay. One of my favorite poems is by Anne Sexton. The Truth the Dead Know. And I found a recording on YouTube of her reading it. So maybe we can listen to that right now.
The Truth the Dead Know. And it was written after my father's funeral, which was just 3 months after my mother's. The Truth the Dead Know. Gone, I say, and walk from church, refusing the stiff procession to the grave, letting the dead ride alone in the hearse. It is June. I am tired of being brave. We drive to the Cape. I cultivate myself, a blushing hermit in the sun, where the sea swings in like an iron gate, and I turn to you and am bright and young. My love, the wind falls in like stones from a white mountain, and where we touch, we are twice marked and twice alone. Men kill for this, or for as much. And what would the dead say? What defiles their calm eyes and their loose brows? Not this, for through their tiny smiles they mutter, "Live now, live now."
That was Anne Sexton reading The Truth the Dead Know.
That was a beautiful poem.
Isn't it? What is this obsession poets have with the dead, though?
Well, that's really interesting you say that, because my first book of poems, another Latino accused me that I was just like all other Mexicans.
Obsessed with the death?
In love with death. And I thought my first book of poems, Calendar of Dust, it wasn't so much that I'm in love with death. In truth, I'm not.
Right.
It's just that I don't ignore the fact that death exists. And a lot of those poems were about people I'd lost.
Right.
And so therefore, and there's a lot of death in the desert. And so they weren't just personal deaths, right. You know, like, you know, so death is really a part of life. It's, and so I just, I'm not a part of that American ideology that's death denying. I'm just, I don't participate in that.
Right.
But I also, but it's also natural to me. I mean, I did grow up going to rosaries all my life.
Right, right. I think there's many reasons why the dead appear a lot in poems and fictions of literary writers. I remember I had a student one time when I first started teaching here, and he goes, "I don't like literary fiction." And I go, "How come?" He goes, "It's all about the dead. I mean, who cares about the dead?" And I thought, "Oh God, this is ridiculous." But later on, I realized he, in a sense, he's kind of right. You know, the fact is, one of the most intense, you know, emotions and intense feelings that we could ever have is when we lose somebody. You know, and so clearly, that's going to appear in our work. But I also think, on another level, when we access a literary landscape, when we access a poetic landscape, when we access a fictional landscape, we're accessing archetype. You know, like if I begin to follow language and I end up on a crossroads, and the crossroads, there's gypsies dancing. Even though I entered it on my own, in essence, as I'm watching those gypsies dancing on the crossroads, Garcia Lorca's on the other side watching them. And there's other writers that are all over that have been throughout the generations, because that image, that archetype has existed long before, you know, I have. And it's going to exist long after I have. And there's even future writers, and we're all gathered around that. So in essence, when we participate in the creation of that kind of archetype, that kind of imagery through language, through incantation, we are gathering with the dead.
Not to mention the fact that though we speak of the dead, the speaker, the writer, is the survivor and very much alive.
Yes.
And so we are all kind of Job's messengers. In the beginning of the book of Job, the messenger comes and he tells them, "Your sons and your daughters and your cows and everything, you've lost everything. And I alone have escaped to tell you."
Nice.
And that's what a poet and a writer does. The tale is always told by the survivor. So it, quite the opposite. Even if you're speaking about death, you're really talking about life.
Yeah. There's this poem by Borges that I love very much. I'm not going to include it today, but it's called "A quien está leyéndome," to whom is reading me, to whoever is reading me. And he's basically telling the reader, "You're dead." You know, the poem ends with this wonderful line. He says, "If you think about it, you know, you're already dead." You know, he's saying basically, as you read this poem, I'm dead. And it's true, because when I started reading that poem, he was dead, but he was aware that the poem was going to last longer than the man. And then that last line, he says, if you think about it, reader, you're dead too.
Exactly. Well, I know we're running out of time, and I wish we had more time.
Oh, no. I got more poems. I'm sure you do, too.
So I'm just going to read a very brief one, and then we can
Okay, and I have a really brief one, too. I think we can get them both done.
Okay, this one is by a friend of mine, Karen Fizer, a wonderful poet, from her book of poems, Words Like Fate and Pain. And it's her first book. It's the first poem in the collection, and it's entitled Across the Border, and its loveliness needs no explanation. Across the Border by Karen Fizer. For you, there was no conscious departure, no hurried packing for exile. You are here anyway, in your own minor archipelago of pain. Do what every exile does. Tell stories. Smuggle characters across the border. Remember things back there as simpler than they were.
Beautiful. Wow. What's her name again?
Karen Fizer. It's a beautiful book.
I'm going to have to look that up. That's wonderful. I have a short one by García Lorca. It's called Despedida. I'll read it in Spanish and I'll just translate it quickly in English. Si muero, deja el balcón abierto. El niño come naranjas. Desde mi balcón lo veo. El segador ciega el trigo. Desde mi balcón lo siento. Si muero, deja el balcón abierto. I love that poem.
That's wonderful.
Let me translate it really quick. When I die or if I die, leave the balcony open. The child eats oranges. From my balcony, I see him. The reaper reaps the wheat. From my balcony, I hear him. If I die, leave the balcony open.
I love that. Leave the balcony over, that command.
Yeah, and I love that image of a balcony open and there's some dead guy there just taking it all in.
Well, Daniel, we could do this forever.
Oh, we could.
But we could just say today, viva la poesía. So maybe we can do this again. And you know
Absolutely.
What we can do next time? For fiction, we could just take some books, some lines or paragraphs from a book.
Favorite lines. Favorite line show.
Oh, and we could say, okay, this, we can set it up and it would be really kind of really interesting.
Ben, we have way too much fun on this show.
Yes, we do.
I really enjoy doing it and I enjoy that I'm doing it with you.
So thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Science.
And don't forget, the next poem you read
may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on the tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place me, a comedy of errors and I'm falling, like a rubberneck giraffe, you look into my past, well maybe you're just too blind to see, I'm up in the spotlight, oh does it feel right, well the altitude seems to get to me.